Hello, and welcome to The Library Coven, a bi-weekly podcast in which two bookish besties discuss mostly YA fantasy through the lens of intersectional feminist criticism. Why? Because talking about books is pretty magical. I'm Jessie.
And I'm Kelly. And today we're talking about House of Marion by J.L., which introduces us to 17-year-old Kel, I think I'm pronouncing that correctly. Yes, audiobook for the win. Who has lived an itinerant life with her mother for reasons, which is namely the forbidden power, quote unquote, that Kel wields. But then they are forced to go directly into the belly of the beast, the magic boarding school her grandmother runs at a lavish estate near New Orleans. The setting was great. We'll talk about that, I'm sure. Will Kel be able to fit into the debutante society and hide her secret from the hot mentor slash assassin? Jordan is his name. I keep calling him Simon.
I had to go look it up because I was like, who is Simon?
I don't know why Simon was in my head. So anyway, will she be able to hide her secret from hot mentor slash assassin Jordan and domineering grandma slash headmistress? Y'all can probably surmise the answer is yes, until the answer is also no. Chaos ensues.
Initial reactions? Do you want to go first?
Sure, I'll go first. The short version is like solidly medium, in my opinion, novel. The book starts off in medias res in like a big and slightly confusing way, but I got oriented to the magical system and intra slash intergroup dynamics eventually. Kel is an intriguing protagonist, and I also appreciate her journey to like self-acceptance and empowerment throughout the story. I do wish there was more backstory for various characters like Kel's grandma and mom, and not just because y'all know I love a backstory, especially like a villain backstory, but it just felt like maybe a little bit thin on maybe some of the like, yeah, like fleshing out some of more of these like emotional connections or like some more history for some characters. What'd you think?
I also listened to the audiobook, which was narrated by Kate Simpsis and Andre Santana, and I'd give this book like 3 stars. So I agree. And I should mention that I like kept changing the star rating as I was writing my notes because it started at a 4.5 and then I brought it down to 3. Like I just kept bringing it down. Mm-hmm. I really like the setting of the story and the magical system was like interesting, but I agree that there also needed to be more backstory. And I feel like I ended the story with a lot of questions. I know there's going to be a sequel, but like, so things might get wrapped up there, but I thought there would be more in the initial book. And like, I'm so confused about things between the grandma and the mom.
Yeah.
Like the mom seemed like she was going to be such a big part of the story and then was like, not at all. So it was just like odd. And I know we'll get into like things we did and didn't like more, but I was just like, huh, I love, like I finished the book on Thursday. Today's Saturday we're recording and I've already, it's like a bit forgettable, which is not great.
I read it probably like at least a month ago, if not more. So I'll do my best, y'all. Dust off the corners of the cobwebs of my memory.
Recommend if you like.
I would say magical school slash boarding school stories in general, the series that shall not be named. Also, a middle grade example would be like The Marvelers by Danielle Clayton. And Danielle Clayton's my rec apparently this time because the Bells series also, because it's like a world that like, it's like cutthroat, but like super beautiful. And so like that juxtaposition, you know?
Yeah. I saw someone say this book was like Mortal Instruments meets the Grishaverse. And I would like to add Folk of the Air to that and like Gossip Girl and the originals. And I think that's like a pretty apt description for like the vibes going on vibes alone. Like, the main character Kel is very like Clary from Mortal Instruments, like coming into this world she doesn't know and she has like some secret power, blah blah blah. And I guess that's the same for the Grishaverse as well, and like, you know, almost like a boarding school-esque. But then like the court intrigue of Folk of Air, the cattiness of Gossip Girl,
yes,
and the setting of the originals
with all those combined. Yeah, totally.
Yes. So why did we choose this book? This book was all over Instagram leading up to and after the release. And we do love to read some popular books sometimes. Plus, we hadn't read anything by JL before. So we kind of thought this would be like a good place to start. Maybe her other books would have been better. I don't know. I haven't read any of them. So anyways.
wasn't her first book or one of the first books of hers that I remember getting hype was like Wings of Ebony or something. And it was from various book clubs and things like that. Right.
Yeah.
I love the cover, though, I will say.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, people also like said Bridgerton-esque. I don't know if I agree with that, but I guess like the balls and stuff, you know.
And gossipy, you know, like anything that's like high society, quote unquote. Yeah, definitely gossipy.
But I guess Bridgerton is just like old timey Gossip Girl.
Pretty much. Pretty much. Time to talk about world building in Through the Wardrobe. New Orleans. I love that how we started out like in the streets, just like wandering around. And I've never been to New Orleans, so it's always like, it's definitely a place I want to visit someday. And yeah, I just feel like it has so much history. And so it's like, you know, polyphonic and just like with how many layers there are to the society. And like, yeah, so I love a New Orleans setting.
Yeah, I really love this part of the book. I have been to New Orleans. It's super wonderful and just like has very magical vibes on its own. If you go, I would recommend going to Cafe Du Mont, which I was like disappointed didn't make like an appearance in the book because it's like so famous. Like they're known for their beignets and they are delicious, but bring cash. And like Madame Louveau, who was like a high priestess and like voodoo, is like there's a museum there for her because she's from there. And so there's like a lot of magic. And I think it's kind of like maybe why like the TV show The Originals, which is a spinoff of Vampire Diaries, it takes place in New Orleans. And it's like super fun to have watched that show and then go to New Orleans. But you can also do like cemetery tours, like ghost tours. Like there's just a lot of stuff. And I know it's like kind of a party town. I didn't do any of that while I was there. But just like, it's just got like really good vibes. And I really enjoyed it and it was a fun time. So yeah, I like that part. I do wish we got more of New Orleans in the book, though.
Yeah, we pretty much had New Orleans for the first, like, maybe 4 or 5 chapters, if that.
Yeah.
And then it's like we're spirited away to this, like, super lavish manor, like, estate place. What was it called? Do you remember?
The Chateau.
The Chateau. Okay, yeah. So, yeah, we've got debutantes and cotillion, so I guess I can see why like the Bridgerton comes up with like all of the presenting yourself to society and stuff like that. The Order, which is like this nebulous institution of like wealth and power hoarding via manipulation and nepotism, so like what's new? Is it IRL? Is it fantasy? Doesn't matter. Crosses lines. It's everywhere.
Yeah. And I actually thought we would see more with like the debutantes and the cotillions because this book takes place in the South. I think they're still in Louisiana when, you know, they're at the chateau or whatever.
Yeah.
I didn't do like cotillion or anything, but it is like a very like Southern thing. So I also just kind of expected like more Southernness in the book. That was like disappointing not to have, but also like, I don't know. I'll get into it later, I guess. But yeah. So I was like, oh, I wish there was more about like Southern culture in the book. So I kind of like missed out on that part a little bit.
Yeah. Maybe that's something else that like would have fleshed out the novel and made it more like visceral and like believable. Maybe the wrong word, but I guess we use it in this context sometimes. So
yeah.
There is, I guess I could have put this in Kill Your Darlings, but there's an appendix with super helpful info about the different magical houses, their powers and histories. And I understand why like people don't put this sort of information up front, probably because we're supposed to go on that journey with the protagonist from knowing nothing to like gradually breadcrumbing our way to more and more information. But like when they were reading this at the end, I was like, oh, this would have been helpful to know / interesting to know a little bit earlier on. But it's like, how do you introduce that information without like spoiling things for people? I don't know. Maybe if she had like read a textbook or something with that information in it, like there maybe would be a way to like put a paratext, you know, I love a paratext into the body of the novel and incorporated it a little bit earlier for people. I don't know what you think about that.
No, I agree. Or I think like sometimes we'll see a book that will have like, you know, the different like magical powers of groups of people, even though we have it like just like a quick little rundown at the very beginning. I think it even was Into Shape a Dragon's Breath had that at the beginning.
I think it's in this book too.
Oh, is it? Oh. I can't reach it. It's under my huge pile of books.
It's not topple. Under your microphone, which is where I usually keep my books that I'm reading.
No. but I think like some of that, I think you can put it at the beginning, because I do think, like, for me, I don't read that part when it's at the beginning of the book until it becomes like necessary. So I think you could do it, and like people aren't going to spoil themselves that much. And like, I mean, it's a young adult book. We all know it's going to all turn out fine in the end anyway. So yeah. Like, maybe we worry too much about spoilers.
Maybe we do. / I love spoilers. I'm an anomaly though.
Yes. Let's discuss all things magic.
So there's like different kinds of magic users, which I don't really remember who everyone was now. It's like people that transfigure things versus people that do other stuff. Oh my God, y'all, this is high quality right here.
Healing. There's healing powers.
Yes.
I'll see if I can get the book out without toppling everything.
You do it. You do it. I believe in you.
Kelly can't see it, but I have like a huge stack of books in my lap now of like 10 books.
I believe it.
Okay. Animators, transfigurer of anatomy. Orator, transfigurer of sound. Shifter, transfigurer of matter. Retinator, remover of magic, which I don't think we saw. Cultivator, transfer of knowledge. I don't really know what that means. And dragon, by invitation only.
Gotcha. Yeah. Okay. So that is helpful. Thank you for that refresher. Yeah. Like a lot of the teachers were cultivators, which is like you can amplify almost someone else's magics, which would make sense to be like why it would be helpful in like a teaching setting. I thought that was kind of cool. We learned that the dragons are basically like this cabal of enforcers for the order, and they are assassins, and they're the ones who get to use all kinds of magic, versus like the students or other people, just normies coming up through the system, have to like choose a specific kind and bind themselves to it. And we see that Kel kind of bucks the system.
Yes.
There's like sunstones, like magical gemstone that is like where people get their power from, maybe. And Tishana is like the kind of, it's literal like dark/black magic. I would not say that in a metaphorical sense. That's what Kel uses, and that's like what's forbidden, probably because it's like very powerful and not very controllable. So, you know, we're seeing how things are going, what the ruling class is trying to do. And there's also this like magical glass orb that people are like very worried about, and it like cracks, and
it's called the sphere.
Okay, excuse me, magical glass sphere. Pardon me.
No, the sphere is a proper noun.
Oh, the sphere, capital S, capital T, capital S. Okay, and it keeps cracking, and then y'all are here for spoilers, so we're gonna give it to you, and then. Some dude who we eventually figure out is important, we'll talk about that later, is like, I need to break the wheel, as Daenerys would say in Game of Thrones. I need to break the orb.
Yeah, and then we also have those like weird diadems/masks that grow out of their heads/onto their faces, which I just like didn't even know what to like think about this part. I've never read anything like it before. It just seems so odd to me. And then I think the diadem/mask seem to correspond to gender identity, but I might have that wrong.
No, I don't think you did.
Okay. There were a lot of names which were like not conventionally gendered, in quotes. So I wasn't really sure how everyone identified. And then I actually read a lot of reviews for the book after I finished it, which I'll get into in somewhere else. One does not simply. But I saw in other folks' reviews that like people seem generally confused about the magical system. I think I was okay with it being like a bit opaque because Kel is like new to the world, but it would definitely need to be more fleshed out in a second book. And I think that kind of goes back to like what you were saying. Like we got so much information about the magic, like at the end in an appendix, and maybe that's just not like the most helpful for readers when I think fantasy readers are used to having like that information up front, or for it to come out in the story. And maybe it was like JL's way of not info dumping, but I don't think it worked out the way that like she wanted it to, kind of, you know what I mean? Like it seemed like a lot of people were confused.
Yeah, and I can see that, especially because like the various magic types seem to map onto these like powerful houses. It was almost like like heritage, you know, like coming from the like genealogy or the lineage of different people. But also like you didn't have to be born into a house to like join a house. So I can see it definitely was a little bit confusing. I thought it was interesting that, like, grandma lectures, or did they call her, she called her grandmom or something? Did you hear that?
Did she?
Maybe I misheard.
I didn't notice it.
Oh, okay. Which I was like, oh, never heard that before. Interesting. The headmistress slash grandmother lectures Kel about the history of magic. And I thought this was like maybe a gesturing at trying to flesh it out more, like back in time, like retcon magic into the world, which I think can be like super successful. So the grandmother and headmistress is saying is that, like, with the rise of capitalism, like beforehand it was like a way more closed magical system, but with the rise of capitalism people didn't have to like hide their magic anymore because they could, like, it was normal to accumulate wealth and resources and power. And so, you know, it's kind of like if the witches from the witch trials, instead of being burned, like became the ruling class, kind of is what I'm gathering from that.
Yeah.
This is like a common theme that we see throughout YA, which I like, is like Kel has to learn to trust her, to Shauna, aka her power slash gift, is other things that we, you know, like languaging that we hear, and by extension herself, and like start thinking for herself instead of just like digesting all of these like narratives and then like repressing her magic. It's like repressing slash afraid of unknown power versus like an accepting and curious approach to your unknown power. Yeah, just like a very YA fantasy character journey, which we saw Mar doing in The Wicked Bargain, which was, we just read.
Yeah, and I think this is like very, like, it's not a trope really, but I think it's just like, well, I guess it's probably like part of the, what is it, Bildung's Roman or whatever. Like, yeah, they're growing up and like, you know, pushing boundaries for the first time. And I think that's just like a normal part of like young adulthood. So it makes sense in like in this world, but also like why we see it so much in YA and especially in YA fantasy.
Mm-hmm. Now we're going to talk about conflict villains, good and evil, in our segment, Get Me Kylo Ren. I put etiquette as the first thing in here because it's just like annoying. And we had just, it was just like in To Shape a Dragon's Breath, we had just talked about this. And yeah, just like the norms are so draconian and limiting. And limited, yeah, etiquette, annoying.
Yeah, I think this is also why I wanted to see like more of this like southern vibe slash New Orleans, you know, setting, because I think this is like such a big part of being from the South, like these little etiquette things that, like, having moved out of the South and like going other places, I'm like, what the fuck is wrong with these people? But really it's just like ingrained in you. Okay, well, some of it I'm like, yeah, your dog does not belong in a Target, and like your kid shouldn't be running around causing havoc all over the store. That would never fly in the South for one second. So sometimes I'm like, maybe other people need to start accepting these things too. But I think that's just a big part of Southern culture. So I think it was interesting to see it, but they just didn't like set it in that, you know? So I don't know.
Yeah.
But it was interesting to see like these very, amped up versions of like Southern etiquette.
Mm-hmm. Almost like in an Austin sort of, like Jane Austen, mm-hmm, sort of level, you know, where,
yeah,
it's just like, so it's just everyone, no one's saying what they actually mean, but communicating, yeah, in these like codes almost. Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah. Versus like, yeah, you're the common courtesy slash etiquette that you're talking about. Yeah, I'm like, yeah, that's good. Okay. Like, please put on shoes in the store. I don't know.
God, yeah.
Yeah. I kind of already mentioned that like dragons are the enforcers of the order, but they seem to be like touted at least like visually before we get further into the novel and learn like how bad the grandma is and stuff, as like the enforcers of the order are the bad guys, TM.
Yeah. Yeah, I thought that was weird too, because they didn't seem to be that bad by the end. So I just was like, maybe that's just another point of confusion for me, because some of them seem to be doing whatever they want, and then some of them seem to be like, "Oh, I'm upholding these silly rules of the order." So I was kind of like, "I don't really know what's going on here."
Yep, maybe we'll find out more in the next book. I'm not sure I'll read the next book, but we'll see.
Yeah, we'll see.
One thing that I feel like maybe we haven't talked in Get Me Kylo Ren, but like seems like can be a through line, is children essentially being like groomed for jobs as adults. And like I feel like that should be the real grooming moral panic, instead of like worrying about, you know, us, those of us in the alphabet mafia, LGBTQIA2S+, et cetera. But it's like, let children discover who they are rather than like imposing a vision of who they need to be in the future, you know?
Yeah. And I think a lot of this is coming from the grandma, which I feel like normally in YA, we get these like super nice, cozy grandmas, like in... Now I can't. Why can I never think
about Alice's from
yes
from Nightmareverse? Exactly. Yeah, yeah.
Thank you. So I thought this was an interesting change to see, like, a kind of like, I don't know if her grandma will actually end up being evil by like the second book, but something's obviously going on with her grandma and like her mom, and so like I feel like this isn't something we normally see. Like, we often get like parents who are not very good with their kids and like are just shitty parents, but we don't often see how that like could come from like generational trauma coming down from their parents and their parents and their parents and on and so forth. But I just thought this was an interesting dynamic that we don't often get in YA, and I thought that was like really fun slash cool.
Yeah, definitely cool to mix it up. I'm not sure in what context this came up, but there was like a for the greater good. It was probably the grandma who, when she's talking about like her hit list of teenagers that she's like orchestrated the killings of, maybe potentially. I don't know. Maybe it's more complicated than that in book two. But yeah, this for the greater good is like a quintessential YA slash just general dog whistle for like power over rather than power with, in my view.
Yeah, there's like that, oh, now I'll never be able to think about it, that term in like philosophy where you like, what's best for the most people? I can't think of it now. My brain is just like...
Majority rule? For. I don't know. That's more politics, I guess.
No. All right, well, I'll never think of it, but there's like this idea in philosophy about like doing best for the... You know, it's like where the trolley problem comes from.
Right.
Like... And so I, like, I understand the idea of it, but I do feel like when we see it used more practically, it's like the, whatever the people in power think is best for everyone, like you're saying, instead of like what is actually good for everyone. So I understand like this idea of like less individualistic and like more of a group dynamic, but it's not really the way it plays out in the real world, you know what I mean?
Yeah, the way it plays out is like minority rule enforcement, basically, or like ruling class doing whatever they want.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Onward, magical friends. Just as one does not simply walk into Mordor, one does not simply read fantasy without talking about representations of race, class, gender, and ability. This is our segment about power and bodies and how they relate.
One does not simply have 13 homes. Oh, wait. Grandma Marion does. I read that and I was like, whoa, bananas. We really are talking about like 1% level wealth, which I feel like sometimes people are like, oh, what is... middle class versus upper middle class versus like top 10% versus like the 1%, and it's like the people who have 13 homes are probably closer to the 1%.
Yeah, wild. Can't even imagine, like, what do you even do with them? Like, they're just sitting empty most of the time. It's wasteful.
Very wasteful. Wasteful on resources. Like, other people who need homes could be living in those empty ass homes. Yeah,
just... I'm sure it drives up housing prices and like housing costs for, you know, like others as well. So I'm just like,
totally
silly.
But yeah, I guess it is one of the tactics of the ruling class is to like put everything in real estate, and then you get to like have more deductions or whatever. I'm not an accountant. I don't know how it works. I just did my taxes and it was a struggle. So don't listen to me about that. I thought that some of the stronger parts of the novel were these like relationship between Abby and Kel and how there was like some friction there, and like the class differences really become apparent in these conversations. Abby has like a family history within the order and like, I guess, a generational legacy of gaining wealth, status, and power. And there's this one interesting part of the conversation where Abby's like saying this to Kel, saying like, are you suggesting I don't use the privilege my position affords me? And that's like a direct quote. And I'm like, yeah, girl, that's what we're saying. Or at least you can get creative about how you use it, because you're never going to be able to like give it fully away, seeing as how like I'm pretty sure she's white and Kel is maybe black, which gets to your next point. So I'll just bracket that.
Yeah, there's just like, it's obvious, like, I guess, I think we would say like, our Kel lives like a transient lifestyle. Like, her and her mom are moving a lot, and like, obviously the last place we see them is in New Orleans, but like, they're not rich. Like, they were like happy to be able to buy a car, and like, Kella is obviously working, and like, she's going, like, at the beginning of the book, she's like going to pick up like her paycheck, which I think she's being paid in cash. Mm-hmm. So yeah, we do really see this dynamic, especially when like Abby and Kel go looking for like Abby's, like, I don't know what they call it, or like her debutante dress or whatever, and mm-hmm. like, money is just like no object. And then we see Kel also coming into that as well, as she's like folded in like under her grandma's wing or whatever. But yeah, this is a good point I did not really pick up on until you brought it up, but yeah, it was just like very, very big.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of big points, this is a beefy paragraph that you've written here. Let's get into it.
I really like an essay. Yeah. Okay, and I brought in a quote, which I like never do, so Kelly, get
doing
ready.
The most. She's citing her sources. It's like she's a librarian or sources. Something.
I know. Who would have thought? So we get this author's note at the beginning that I think is super important for like One Does Not Simply. And it says, quote, "The fictional setting and events in the House of Marion are inspired by various parts of the world. None is intended as a faithful representation of any one event, culture, or people at any point in history," end quote. So like, this didn't really make sense to me, and I didn't really think anything of it when I started the book. I just thought there was going to be like a mashup of different cultures and history, which I thought would have been cool. But then as I was reading, I realized that I don't think we get a description of Kel other than she has loose curls and at one point saying her knuckles turned white. Now I could have been wrong or missed something, but this really threw me off. So I went to the author's Instagram and Pinterest pages to see if there were like any character inspiration pics. Pinterest has a wide range of racial / ethnic groups represented, but they didn't like point to any specific characters. So I'm not really sure about Kel's race / ethnicity. I do not think that Black authors have to write Black characters, but I was really surprised about the lack of discussion around race / ethnicity in the book, mm-hmm. especially a book that takes place in the South with discussions of etiquette and power balances. So I think I mentioned this earlier, but like, I looked at a bunch of reviews to see if it was just me, but I saw other like Black reviewers mentioning Kel's racial ambiguity. And this was just really disappointing to me in a genre where there has been so much work to have more inclusive books and like a wide range of diversity represented without the description of Kel. And I will point out that other characters did get more full descriptions. It makes me feel like the book was written so that anyone could see themselves as Kel, but it actually just makes me feel like left out, unrepresented, and as if this was meant to appeal to like a non-POC audience instead like as a way to sell more books. Mm-hmm. So like, is this a hot take? Maybe, probably, but it's also 2024 and I thought we had moved past this. So like, this is what really brought it down to 3 stars for me, was like thinking back and being like, I don't know how you have a book like set in this area, like with these themes, and just like every other character's race is described except for Kel, her grandma, and Kel herself. Like, that just makes no sense to me. Like, we know Abby is white, like she's described that way.
Right.
So rant over, I guess, but also this like left me a little sour.
I'm so glad that you brought this up, because this is not something I caught. I think I just kind of assumed that Kel was Black, probably because the author is Black and because like there's like gorgeous cover art of her previous novel with like as a mm-hmm. Black protagonist. So yeah, that's my bad for just assuming something. Yeah, you're so totally right about this, now that I'm like dusting, you know, off of my memory of the book. I'm like, no, this is really true, especially if you're gonna, like you said, talk about like class, like in the South, like how did class become a thing in the South? Oh wait, because of chattel slavery, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, this is definitely a missing.
Yeah, and when you look at the appendix, one of the houses was started before the end of slavery, and then the House of Marion was started like, I think it was maybe like 10 years after, and I'm like, oh, are we not going to discuss what that might have looked like for Black people with these magical powers? Like, mm-hmm. and like, Kel is described as having like loose curls, and like, I would say that could like be fitting for anyone. Like, I have looser curls, but not loose curls, and I'm biracial. And a reviewer that I saw did make mention that JL is biracial or multiracial. So I also like, I'm just like frustrated by that. like, there's just so many places you could have gone with that. So I feel like I just missed out on like some of the nuances that would have also like fleshed the story out more. So like by putting up this like author's note at the beginning and saying like, oh, I'm not talking about anyone specific, I'm like, yeah, but that just gives the assumption of whiteness because people think that's the default. So it just felt very unfair to me and I was really disappointed.
Yeah, and it's also interesting to think about like the publishing landscape and like the workflow. So like, who knows if this was originally included and then an editor was like, we need to make this character more universal and it's like a non-negotiable or whatever. And I'm like, yeah, I'm not trying to like minimize anything you're saying, but it's interesting to think about like when at this like was this the original draft, was this how it's always been, is this like an omission from in post in editing or something, because it feels like a big omission, like you said.
Well, especially because like the first book, Ebony, Wings of Ebony, has like a black character prominently on the front, and then I realized this book does not have a character on the front. Mm-mm. And it made me think of like, you and I went to like the Colorado Teen Literature Conference, and Sadia Mannion, who write, what is that book called?
When Dimple Met Rishi.
Yeah. Talked about how like they wanted like the publishers originally, not maybe the one she ended up with, but a publisher didn't want an Indian American person on the cover. And it just kind of make me think of like all those things that like people of color go through to get their books published. And then to just like kind of ignore all that work that came before was like frustrating.
Mm-hmm. And just goes to show that like, yeah, whiteness is still seen as the default, when in reality, like when we niche down and get more particular and more detailed and nuanced about a person's actual experience in their body mind as it is racialized, you know, then it actually becomes like way easier to connect with, instead of this like fake universality of whiteness, you know?
Yeah.
All right, it's time for Shipwrecked, a segment about asexuality, sexuality, sex, romance, and relationships. And sometimes we take liberties and do some shipping of our own, or we like blast cannonballs at the ship because we're maybe not that into it. do you ship Kellan Jordan? Because like, I wasn't a huge fan, although I can see the allure of the powerful bad boy / head boy figure. At one point, there's like this point where not Simon, Jordan, suggests a permanent magical bond. And I was like, girl, no, you're 17. What if you break up? And then, of course, it becomes a point of contention later. And by later, I mean like
almost immediately.
20 minutes later.
Yeah, I agree. Jordan was kind of like meh for me. I felt like he was supposed to be like a Kaz Brecker character, if Kaz was like the consummate rule follower, but it just didn't land. I think in part because their relationship goes from like hating each other to like one good conversation and all of a sudden they are in love. It was just too fast and like not well developed enough. So we kind of get this like whole forced proximity thing, which is a trope that I love, because Jordan is Kel's mentor, but it just didn't like come off super well. And I don't know, there was just like too much hating and not enough moving into the like, they, like there's too much enemies, not enough lovers. And there was like no in between as they moved from enemies to lovers. So I was just kind of like, I mean, he looks like a bad boy too, and he's not. He's just like a rule follower. Like, he's like a bootlicker. So I'm also kind of like,
yes,
whatever.
He is.
Not interested.
We do not ship.
Sorry.
Especially because Kel is like, you know, by like necessity, you know, trying to like untangle herself from the rules. She's like, tries to follow the rules and then is like, hold on, everything they're telling me to like hate myself and repress everything, and maybe I shouldn't do that. And I think like Jordan is kind of like a foil for that, right? Because he like hates the fact that he has to use Tashana, or that he has to like expel it, which I guess we should have said that it's like destructive. It like crumbles things and destroys things, which is like some things need to be destroyed, which is a point that Kel gets to, you know, a realization that she comes to later on in the book.
Even though I don't ship Jordan and Kel, I did, however, like the dynamic between Kel and Abby. I thought their, like, blossoming friendship was very realistic. And even though there was, like, a lot about party planning and silly things, they also had, like, their very first argument and came to understand each other. And Abby seemed, like, kind of, like, a ride-or-die friend. Although I will not be surprised if Abby turns out to have like ulterior motives in the next book. But for the moment, she seems like a little too good to be true. But like, it seems like a genuine friendship that I was like, oh, this is kind of nice to see. And there was like no real cattiness between them, even though like Kel got like really popular all of a sudden and she's gained like invitations to all these places that Abby wants to go to. But Abby wasn't like shitty about it, which I was like, oh, that's nice to see. Because I think we see a lot of like, not as much anymore, but I think especially when we were first starting the podcast, like we would see like a lot of cattiness between like girl characters, which is just like kind of unnecessary.
Yeah. This dynamic also reminded me of Anacus and Marta in To Shape a Dragon's Breath, right? Like you have the outsider coming in and then you have like the generational legacy who's, you know, can be a friend in certain situations. Marta, I think, is like less of a ride or die than Abby. But yeah, it is like, it makes me think of, I know you didn't read Babel or the whole thing, but like there's this white character, Letty, in the group of POC.
Oh,
like
yeah.
There's three non-white characters or three POC characters and then one white person. And of course she like turns out to be bad and like can't put her own privilege / like needs aside long enough to like actually be a comrade in the struggle. And that's just kind of what I expect, honestly, from white side characters.
Me too.
Unless they prove me wrong.
We'll see in, you know, another book. Maybe we'll see what Abby's like. Now we're going to talk about writing style, narration, characterization, plot structure, and basically whatever else comes to mind in Kill Your Darlings.
Side character development felt like kind of superficial to me. And that could also be because the side characters themselves like are superficial, as in like vanity and that in that sort of vein, I mean.
Yeah.
So I guess I was like the appendix with like information about the houses maybe would have made it a bit more robust. But yeah, just putting that here.
No, I agree. And I think especially because we see so much about like people like, especially at the House of Marion, like they're trying, or at the chateau, they're like getting kicked out if their powers don't like come out and stuff. And everyone's like, just like, eh, I guess it happens and just move on. Like they're even superficial when it comes to like the power dynamics going on. So I can see that for sure.
We had multiple POVs, so it was like mostly Kel, but then some Yagrin, who is like random dude, but turns out not to be a random dude. He's Jordan's other older brother, gasp, and he's a dragon, but then his partner gets killed by his other dragons because he's like trying to stand up for what's right. I kind of forget like the inciting incident.
His partner, but like girlfriend partner, not like partner in crime,
not like good cop bad cop partner. And then so Yagrin is like goes off the deep end and is like, hold on, break the wheel, gotta break the wheel. And then he is looking for the magic sphere, not magical orb. We don't find that out until the very end when Jordan is confronting Yagrin and Yagrin's like, no, I'm gonna destroy this glass thing. Deal with it.
Yeah, which also didn't work. He didn't destroy anything. They're just like a crack that and it won't break. But I was actually like so confused about who Yagrin was for the whole book. At first I thought like once we met Jordan, I was like, oh, is he Jordan? No. And then I think Abby or Shelby has like a boyfriend who's like not really like welcome, and I was like, oh, is it Abby's boyfriend? No. And then I think like Shelby, who is like a side character who's being like real shitty once Kel like it's all powerful or whatever, I think she also has a weird boyfriend that we don't really see, and I was like, is that who this is? So I will say I did not see this coming.
No, me either.
But I also don't know how necessary his POV was. I'm not sure it added much to the story because we already know like somebody is after Kel from the beginning. So this part was just like also like, I don't know that we needed this. And I don't know that the big reveal that it was Jordan's brother was like necessary. I don't know. It just felt like weird and like tacked on. Mm-hmm. So I did not appreciate this. It just was confusing.
It could have like maybe been more effective if it were like Witcher style, like the other POV is narrating in the past and going forward. Mm-hmm. That could have been like interesting, especially because it would have given us more information about like what said orb is and how it came to be. Yeah. Like maybe if it were like the person who was in charge of like repressing the Tashana and starting this world order or whatever, that would have maybe been more effective for me than this contemporaneous like rando guy that we find out is actually important maybe at the end of the book.
Yeah, agreed.
I'm just like curious, why A and assassins? Like why? There's so many of them. It's just so funny to me, you know?
Maybe young people just think about murder a lot. This is a way for them to experience that in a safe way.
a safe way. To me, it seems kind of like spies for adults or like international, because they're like the peak of like competence and like hyper independence.
They're all oldest siblings.
Yep. It's just kind of funny. Yeah, it's like a way of exploring power in a safe fictional way, I guess.
Before we end, it's time for real talk. Did reading this book make your perspective change in any way, or did it make you interrogate a concept, system, or trend that you hadn't before? As per usual, Kelly is the only one who wrote anything in here.
And they brought a quote, as per usual. Man, Kel has this like realization, and I was just like, oof, this hits hard. It's resonating for sure. It's like when she decides to like marry herself, for lack of a better word, than like marry the society or plunge the dagger into her heart and like pledge herself to her grandma or whatever, who would then like be tracking her with find my iPhone, but like find my grandma, a granddaughter or whatever. Yeah, Kel realizes that joining the society, like for real, would be like, quote, stepping from one cage into another. I'm like, ooh, I'm glad you realized that at 16 or 17, because, man, that was one of the reasons why I decided not to stay in academia, is because, like, I was doing the PhD and, like, checking boxes for, you know, imposed on me. And then I was like, wait, you're telling me that if I manage to hit the holy grail of tenure, which is not guaranteed by any means, then I would just be stepping from one cage into another 7-year to-do list where other people are evaluating you and telling you whether you're good or bad or right or wrong. And I was like, I'm going to choose a different path. None of the above.
Yes. And I guess that's kind of what Kel decides as well. Like, she's just not going to do it. Kind of, I guess. I don't really know. I don't know where this goes after this. I don't think I'll read the next book, if I'm being honest.
I don't think I will either.
Maybe I'll give Wings of Ebony a try, but I think I would look at like a lot of reviews first to be like, is this worth my time? Because I just didn't really enjoy this one that much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, fair enough. Okay, I got everything else out besides the cards. One sec. Okay, let's see what the cards have in store. What was the main character's catalyst for change?
I don't know. She's real worried about her mom.
Yeah. She's very worried about her mom. I think when she realized her grandma is hiding lots of things from her, that was one of the turning points. And maybe also when she realized that using her magic feels good.
Yeah.
Despite like what everyone else is telling her that it is bad. But like she's actually, you know, thinking and feeling for herself. I think that that was another axis that change things. What is the main character most loyal to? Her mom, maybe?
I think so, yeah.
Which character would you least like to be?
Oh. I don't know. Maybe it's hard because, like,
maybe Jordan.
I was going to say that. I couldn't decide between him or the grandma, you know?
Yeah. Didn't we have scenes with his dad, too, his parents, and then they seem like super shitty.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Okay, one more.
Yeah, we can do
one more. I feel like we did three, but we can do one more. If you were a teacher, what question would you ask on the final essay?
I don't believe in essay questions, so I would ask them to tell me their thoughts and feelings about this book. What did you enjoy, not enjoy? I feel like, I don't know. I don't think essay questions are necessary. I think it's silly. People just enjoy books. Like, that's fine.
Yeah, I don't know if we need to evaluate. Yeah, if you were a teacher, what question would you ask on the final essay? I would do contract grading and make it more democratic. And if the person wanted to write an essay, they could. But if they wanted to make a video, they could do that. And
yeah,
I don't know.
Or maybe even like, because I do, you know, teaching library classes, like I like being like, okay, if you were going to suggest this book to someone, what would you tell them? Or if you had to suggest a book based on this one, like a reader loved it, like what books would you choose? Which is less of an essay question and more of just like a, you know, practicing your librarian skills question.
Use the internet question.
Yeah, learn how to use stuff like Novelist and other places. So, yeah.
All right. Thanks for listening to the Library Coven. We'll be back in 2 weeks for a discussion of I Feed Her to the Beast and the Beast Is Me by Jameson Shea, which I just finished listening to and I'm super excited to talk to you about because I'm like, it's like so horror-y and I love it. And ballet, which is like its own horror.
Yeah.
It's very good. It's very good. I'm excited to talk to you about it. As always, we'd love to be in conversation with you people. Let us know what you think of the episode, anything we missed, or say hi by reaching out to us on Instagram, or you can find us on email at thelibrarycoven@gmail.com.
You can subscribe to The Library Coven on the podcast app of your choice. And we really appreciate it if you would rate and review the show and let other people know what we're talking about. You can support our labor financially. You can make a one-time donation on Ko-fi, support us on Patreon, or by shopping at our bookshop.org affiliate page. Until next time, stay magical.